It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck. Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My guest today is Ben Shapiro. Ben entered UCLA at the age of 16, where he graduated summa cum laude. He also graduated Harvard Law School cum laude back in June of 07. He is the author of Brainwashed, Porn Generation, and Project President. He is here today to talk to us about his latest book, Primetime Propaganda, The True Hollywood Story of How the Left Took Over Your TV. Ben, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Ben, I want to ask you a question. A lot of people are going to look at this title and say, I know Hollywood is full of liberals. Everybody knows that. Why do I need this book to tell me that? What does the book offer beyond the obvious fact that Hollywood is full of liberals?
I mean, I think that the first thing that it offers is an insider's perspective into Hollywood. I mean, it really is a behind-the-scenes look at how your shows get made and what the people who are making them think. So it's not just a third party, oh, well, you know, TV's liberal. Look, everybody knew that the media was liberal, and then Bernie Goldberg went inside and he said, here's what they think of you. And that's what this book is. It really is, here's what they think of you. That's number one. Number two, it really is an analysis of why the left's most common excuse is just utter nonsense. Their most common excuse over and over is, well, if you don't like it, just turn the channel. And I spent about half the book just debunking that. It's not true. We don't have the option to turn the channel. Everything that we turn to looks the same, sounds the same, has the same politics. And that's for a reason. It's because the same people dominate every side of the industry. So it really is an analysis. It's also a look at the way forward here. You know, it analyzes, by the way, also the relationship between Hollywood and the federal government, Hollywood and interest groups. It shows how Hollywood has been systematically corrupted and become a tool of the left. It's not just that it you know, promotes leftist messages. It's in many cases it actively is promoting the Democratic Party agenda. But beyond that, it also offers solutions. It talks about how, you know, we really need to get active in the conservative movement. It talks about how we can go about doing that. It talks about how we cure the problem.
One of the things that was true during the 2008 election is that the right just got clobbered by the left when it came to things like YouTube videos. I think John McCain's group may have released 250 videos on YouTube as opposed to nearly 2,000 by Barack Obama's. Why is it that the left seems to be so good at controlling the media, whether it's the music industry, the television industry, the movie industry, or even something like social media like YouTube or Twitter?
I think the right tends to ignore it. I think that we tend to think of ourselves as very serious people, right? A lot of us are religious. We tend to think life isn't a joke. We tend to think that it's not about fun. It's not about socializing. The left doesn't have those same sorts of issues. They don't care. They'll do whatever's entertaining, whatever's fun. And then they recognize that they have to take that same sense of fun and entertainment into the public square. And when they do that, they're unbelievably successful. The right needs to recognize that even though we pretend that we're not interested in social media, even though we pretend we're not interested in entertainment, we consume just as much entertainment as the left does. We consume just as much social media. We need to stop lying to ourselves and recognize the power of the social media, the power of film, the power of television. And we need to stop pretending that everything can just be thought out. It's so interesting. You know, you listen to Rush Limbaugh, and Rush is fantastic. But one of the things Rush always says is he always says, if you listen to the left is all emotion. There's no reason. Yeah, well, it works. That's the whole thing, right? I mean, if we're all a reason and no emotion, nobody wants to hang out with Data on a Saturday night, right? I mean, everybody wants to be with the fun guy. You always want to hang out with a certain group of people who are actually going to have a good time and aren't going to be judgmental and aren't going to, you know, bug the hell out of you for watching a movie on a Saturday night. And so it's important that we recognize that fundamental truth about ourselves, or we're never going to get anywhere here.
I think that's a great point. I do believe we consume a lot of social media. I'm 48 years old, and I probably spend as much time on Twitter and Facebook as anybody that's in college right now. Part of that has to do with the fact that I see it as a way of getting out a conservative message. But one of the things you point out in the book, or you talk about in the book, is how all this came about. I mean, this didn't start with Cheers. This didn't even start with MASH, I don't think. I mean, liberals have been in control of Hollywood for some time. Tell the listeners how exactly the liberals came to be in control of Hollywood.
They really came to be in control of Hollywood through the creative process. What I mean by that is if you look at the founders of the TV industry, just like the founders of every other industry, they're conservatives, because conservatives are the ones who are entrepreneurs. But the creatives, right, the creative types, They're all liberals. And so at the very beginning, there was a lot of conflict in the creators and the executives. Over time, that sort of wore away. And soon enough, the executive halls were filled by creative types. That's because the advertising industry tends to be filled with people who are both business savvy and also tend to be kind of more artsy. And so as soon as the executives in the halls became more liberal, they started greenlighting more and more liberal programming. By the early 1970s, the transformation was ready to take place. And what prompted that transformation was actually a business consideration. It was actually a business con on the part of ABC. At the time, there were only three major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. CBS was kicking the hell out of everybody. I mean, they were really just destroying everyone in the ratings, and that's because they had affiliates everywhere, rural areas, urban areas, everywhere. ABC, by contrast, only had affiliates in urban areas, right, only major cities. And so what they decided to do is they had to basically make the case to advertisers that even though they had less people watching, they had the right people watching. So what did they do? They said, well, voila, we'll falsify some social science that basically suggests that young urban people are more valuable to advertisers than older rural people, right? So CBS may have more viewers, but, you know, as for us, we have the better viewers. There's only one problem with that. If you think about it for half a second, it makes no sense, right? Why exactly would young urban people be worth more than older rural people, especially when older rural people have all the disposable income in this country? People who are 18 to 34 are unemployed. They're living in mom and dad's basement. And at the very best, they're college students. And you know, they have a lot of debt. So the reason the TV industry has continued to push this notion is because, surprise, surprise, the most liberal demographic in the country by far is the 18 to 34 group. And so all of the people in the TV industry have been able to basically pull one over on the advertisers and essentially make the case that their own liberal proclivities, the stuff they like to program, is market-friendly, when in fact it really isn't.
I have to tell you, I may be an exception in some ways, because even though I do consume a lot of social media, when I was going through your book, and again, I'm 48, so I'm a lot older than you, I did not recognize a lot of the television shows. I have gradually been pulling away from television for some time, and wow, this is a crazy idea. I've actually spent the extra time reading books. So,
I think that's true for a lot of people. I think that if you look at the TV numbers, yeah, they're still unbelievably high. They're not quite as high as they used to be. They're finding other outlets. People go on the internet. You know, people want to watch Netflix. And this is one of the things that's going to bring down Hollywood and the current structure is the fact that we have so many new options that we didn't used to have, and I think that that's a wonderful thing. But I think conservatives, we better not make the mistake with the new options that we made with the old options and basically leave the battlefield.
If we ever engaged at all, it's amazing how much better the left is at all this stuff. Now, one of the things in the book that sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say confused me, but made me think twice, is that you sort of refer to a lot of this messaging as being very subtle, being, insidious. I think it's very overt. I mean, some people would look at these shows and say, okay, MASH was a liberal show about war is bad. You know, Will and Grace, that's kind of obvious. And you go down the list, and typically the theme of the show is pretty obvious. So what's subtle about it?
I think what's subtle about it is not necessarily the cases like MASH where it's just overtly anti-war. But what is really subtle about it as a general matter is they create characters who you want to hang out with and want to be with, right? I mean, that's how television makes its money, by creating people who you like. And then they make those people do things that you don't necessarily care for, but you like the people so much that you keep watching and you sort of start making excuses to yourself why you're watching. So you watch a show like Friends, right? And everybody's very funny and very witty and very likable. And they're getting pregnant out of wedlock, and they're having sex with anything that moves, and you know they don't have jobs, and they're kind of useless human beings as a general matter. But you like them so much that you're willing to excuse everything that they do. And I think that that's really where the subtlety comes out. If you watch Friends, you're not sitting there thinking this is a Democrat diatribe. You watch MASH, it's much more overtly messaged, right? It's an anti-war diatribe. You watch Friends, you're not sitting there thinking this is really egregious. The fact is, it is really egregious. I mean, there are certain episodes that become very preachy, but there are others that are pretty subtle. For example, you know, the fact is that when Rachel has a baby out of wedlock, right? She has a baby out of wedlock from Ross, and Ross is the father, and she's in love with him, and she just decides, kind of, okay, I'm not going to get married to him, and she's kind of taken as for granted, right? Nobody even debates it. This is the left has figured this out. If you look back at the older shows, All in the Family, MASH, the left hadn't figured out subtlety yet. The left wanted to hit you over the head with their politics. Right, Archie was just a horrible human being, and it's because he was conservative. And MASH, it was all about just being tremendously and overtly anti-war. By the time you get to Friends, they're not even contemplating the issue. They're just having the characters do things. Nobody comes out of the woodwork to say, wait a second, isn't that kind of morally questionable? Everyone just accepts it as kind of a fait accompli, and I think that actually makes more of a difference in the culture than the overt MASH kind of stuff. Because you can always disown the overt MASH kind of. It's easy to disown things when you recognize them. Much more difficult when you don't recognize what's going on.
Well, is it a case of Hollywood shaping society, or is it merely art reflecting society?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When I talk to the people who made these shows, for the most part, they tended to think they were reflecting society. There's only one problem. They're reflecting their own society. They're reflecting what goes on in San Francisco and Chicago and New York and L.A. They're not reflecting what goes on in Birmingham, Alabama. And so the real fundamental truth here is that, and I discussed this at length in Primetime Propaganda, the real fundamental truth here is that when it comes right down to it, they're reflecting their own lives and they are transforming everyone else's, and they know it. For a group of people who really hate imperialism, this is the greatest group of cultural imperialists probably in human history.
Now, I'm going to throw something out at you. I asked you a question about the subtlety of some of these messages. I have to admit, even though I've pulled away from TV, I was a television junkie when I was younger, and in college I was a bit of a television junkie, and I started thinking through some of these old shows in preparation for doing this interview. And let's take MASH, for example. Even though it was obviously not about the Korean War, it was more about the Vietnam War, there were some subtle messages in there regarding, say, homosexuality. There was a scene where I think a private had been beaten up, and Hawkeye asked him what happened. And the guy said, there were two guys in my unit who were beaten up. One was homosexual and one was Negro. The guy saying that was white, so Hawkeye looked at him and said, so you're a Negro. Now, what that was subtly doing was equating the civil rights movement to the gay rights movement, which is something that liberals have been doing for a long time. The civil rights movement is probably the only thing they ever got right, so they like to compare everything to that. Al Gore frequently compares, you know, environmental issues to the civil rights movement. But would you agree that that's an example of a subtle message?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the kind of stuff they do on a regular basis. By the way, gay marriage is probably the single greatest evidence that the left's television has had an impact on the rest of us. If you poll Americans right now, I think it's the majority of Americans think that 1 in 4 Americans is gay. Now, that's just insane. I'm sorry, that's crazy. The fact is that the statistics show it's like 2 to 5% maximum. That's at a high end. Right? I mean, so why do so many Americans think 1 in 4 Americans is gay? Because if you look at television, what you're really looking at is basically on TV, 1 in 4 Americans is gay. I mean, it's amazing. It's the only area of American life where it's pretty close to the truth. The only problem, of course, is that it's not true, and by making it so ubiquitous, it justifies it to everybody else. And by the way, I've spoken to creators who said they do this on purpose. I mean, Mark Cherry, who's a gay guy who created Desperate Housewives, he said, I put gay neighbors on with Cyril Lane in order to forward social progress, basically so that people would see, okay, well, if you have gay neighbors, it's not the end of the world. Now, that's not a bad thing. But when it comes to gay marriage, there's no question that they're doing exactly the same thing and that they're kind of making it innocuous. And they've made it so that you kind of feel uncomfortable condemning gay marriage now, even if you're a religious person. You kind of feel like you now have to make excuses. Yeah, I'm anti-gay marriage, but, you know, I don't hate gay people. Nobody said you did, except for the Hollywood left.
That's exactly correct. And I think, was it the Seinfeld show that came up with the expression, not that there's anything wrong with that? And I've heard people say that numerous times when they're attacking gay marriage, you know, and they'll say, but I want to make it very clear. I mean, you know, homosexuality in general, and not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying marriage should be between a man and a woman. They go out of their way to let people know that they're not a homophobe.
It's a defensive move now. I mean, they've put us on the defensive because of this, because the implication is that if you are anti-gay marriage, you must be an enormous bigot. You must be the kind of guy who's going to, you know, go out and beat the tar out of Matthew Shepard. That's who you are if you're anti-gay marriage. In Hollywood, by the way, that's exactly what they think. They think that that's exactly who you are, and that's why if you're anti-gay marriage, you will not get a job in Hollywood. It's really that simple. They just will not hire you because they figure that you're just a bigot and a homophobe and a nasty human being. Unfortunately, they've kind of put that over on the rest of the United States, so people feel uncomfortable now. Even if they know they're right, they feel uncomfortable saying they're anti-gay marriage because they know that everybody's looking at them kind of, you know, with their heads tilted to one side, thinking, oh, you know, that guy, he's just a closet, you know, kook waiting to go off on somebody.
We all are. And that's one of the favorite tools of the left, is just to label us all as conspiracy theorists, as racist, as homophobes, you name it. And in terms of your statement regarding gay marriage or Obama's policies or, you know, anything that the left happens to disagree with, and they're going to come at you, you know, with these charges. I mean, it's actually gotten to the point, I was a lifeguard once, and they always cautioned me in my training when I was getting my certification, if you blow your whistle too much, you're going to eventually have no one pay attention to you. And frankly, the left is throwing out these charges of racism and homophobe so often that I would hope that at some point people stop paying attention to it.
That would be nice. I mean, I think that it's starting to kind of wane with regard to racism. I think with regard to homophobe, it's going to take a while longer.
Now, another message in MASH that I found, and this is kind of a tie-in to the show's main theme, is anti-gun. I mean, for example, there was a scene where Colonel Potter and Hawkeye were in a ditch and they were being shot at, and Hawkeye refused to fire back. In fact, when he was ordered to fire his weapon, he fired it into the air, having no knowledge of physics that would tell him that the bullet would be traveling at about the same speed when it came back to Earth. But that didn't worry him at that time. Now, also, there was a scene where they were doing a medical prisoner exchange with the Chinese, and Hawkeye and Trapper were very upset with Frank Burns for bringing a gun to the exchange, even though all the Chinese had them. And there was yet another scene where the camp was being fired on by snipers, and Hawkeye seemed very, very disapproving of the fact that the U.S. military eventually shot the guy who was shooting at the camp. So
yeah.
There was also...
I mean, the whole premise of the show is the wastefulness of war, and anybody who uses a gun on our side must therefore be a bad person because he's just contributing to the wastefulness of war. I mean, I spoke to the creators of MASH. I spoke to Larry Gelbart before he died, and I spoke with... it would be hard to speak with Matt after he died, but I spoke with him before he died, and I spoke with... Gene Reynolds, who's one of the producers on MASH. I spoke with a bunch of people who worked on Perlusky, and they all said that the common theme was always the wastefulness of war. That's what it was supposed to be about. All these politicians who failed, and that's why we're at war. Well, no, you know, sometimes we go to war because there are actual issues at stake. In the vast majority of the cases, actually, if you look in United States history, with maybe the possible exception of what's going on in Libya, there's a real reason for us to be in the places that we're at, even if, you know, you think it's illegitimate. But this was a real pacifist show, and so the idea of firing your gun into the air when ordered to fire at the enemy is something that Hollywood thinks is brave, because they think that, oh, well, you know, at least you're not contributing to the carnage that is war. Well, you know, in some cases, you really ought to be contributing to that carnage when the people on the other side are bad people who want to implement, for example, global communism. And that might be a good, you know, enslave millions of people and then murder them, as they did in Vietnam. I mean, maybe that's a good time for us to stand up for principle. But Hollywood never thinks it's a good time to stand up for principle when it means actually using a gun.
Well, one of the things I'll argue with you on is whether or not we should be in Libya. If we're going to further the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, we have to be there.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's pretty clear what President Obama's agenda is in Libya, and you're exactly right. I mean, this is a man who is deeply entrenched in the Muslim Brotherhood ideological camp. I mean, everything, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on, or rather, the opposite. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. With President Obama, how many times have you got to be fooled here? I mean, he sides with communists in Honduras. He then goes ahead and he sides with a bunch of Muslim crazies in Tunisia. Then he turns around and sides with a bunch of Muslim crazies in Egypt. Now he's done it in Libya. He's about to do it in Syria. I mean, I'm not sure how much more evidence we need. In all of this, he's throwing Israel under the bus. How much more evidence do we need that he's on the wrong ideological side here?
I was convinced a long time ago, but then again, I was convinced before the election. Also, want to go
yeah,
back
me too.
I want to go back to MASH for just a second. Not only was it important to the creators of MASH to paint anyone who was gung-ho American as bad, whether it was Frank Burns, Margaret Houlihan, Colonel Flagg, or if you remember an early appearance by Harry Morgan in the series, he appeared as a crazy general named General Steele. Anyone that was gung-ho American was a nutcase. On the other hand, the enemy was always portrayed as very, very kind and compassionate. There's that scene where Hawkeye and BJ are actually saved by a Chinese soldier, I believe. I can't remember if it was Chinese or North Korean, but I think it was North Korean. And so he basically help them stay alive as another combat unit came by. There was a scene where Frank Burns was captured by the Chinese, and instead of killing them the way it certainly would have been done in war, they just told him to get out of the Jeep. There were so many times when we saw the enemy just being painted as very kind and compassionate, certainly not like the U.S. soldiers who were all about killing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some truth to that. As a general matter, the division in MASH was between the enlisted men and the officers. It was always the enlisted men were the ones who were, you know, they were generally good folk. It was just their superior officers were the ones who were boobs and nasty pieces of, you know, garbage. And the people on the other side, well, they were just fighting for their country's freedom. I mean, there's no question what MASH's agenda was. And the people who made the show admitted it to me. And that's what's so astonishing in primetime propaganda. I just walked through the front door. I asked them some simple questions. They answered them. And all of a sudden, everyone seemed surprised that they answered the questions honestly. Well, you know, if anybody else had asked them, they probably would answer them honestly, too. The only difference is that I happen to be conservative.
I think the telltale episode for me on how they were going to paint the enemy is, do you recall the one about 5 o'clock, Charlie?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, I guess it was way before your time. But they had a guy that would try to bomb the ammo dump every day. And they called him 5 o'clock Charlie. He was a really, really bad shot with dropping bombs. And so every day everybody would get out their lawn chairs and they would place bets on how close Charlie would get to the ammo dump. And so they were basically painting the enemy in Korea as not being a serious threat. Now, I don't want to make the whole interview about MASH. One of the things you note in the book is that a lot of our American television series actually are imports from Great Britain. Sanford and Son was based on a show in Great Britain called Steptoe and Son, although the characters were actually white. All in the Family was based on a show called Till Death Us Do Part. Three's Company was based on a show called A Man About the House. Now, Great Britain is certainly way ahead of us when it comes to liberalism, as well as socialism, although we're trying very hard to catch up right now. If we're going to keep importing shows from Great Britain, aren't we going to continue to be hit with a smattering of highly liberal offerings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, look, Hollywood always has a tendency to go after what's successful. So when they see a show and they think it's a really great show, they're going to bring it overseas. But I think the reason that Till Death Us Do Part, for example, was brought over was not only because it was a successful show in Great Britain. It was also because it was a very liberal show. Well, in the same way that if you import international law into United States courtrooms, it's going to end up with more liberalism. It's certainly true of television, too. I mean, if you're going to take foreign shows and you're going to make those the basis of American shows, foreign countries are more liberal than we are. Of course it's going to have an effect, and I think that's certainly been the case over the course of TV history.
Now, you've taken some heat lately for attacking Sesame Street and Big Bird and Ernie and Bert. What kind of a sicko are you, Ben, attacking something as fine and wholesome as Sesame Street?
It's just hysterical. I mean, the left is trying to paint me as Jerry Falwell in the Teletubbies here. If you read that section of the book is like a page and a half long. And I talked to the people who created Sesame Street, and they were very obvious about this. Yes, it's a liberal show. Everybody knows it's a liberal show. Anybody who denies it is lying or ignorant. And you know, it was so funny. I made a joke on Sean Hannity's program. His TV show about the left is making it seem like I want to go out back and cap Elmo and Big Bird, and the left went absolutely berserk over this. I mean, the Salon.com ran a piece where one of the commenters said that it was rhetoric like that led to the shooting of Gabby Giffords.
Mm-hmm.
I replied to that. I said, well, you know, do you guys recognize that Elmo and Big Bird are not actually real people? That they're actually immortal. You can't kill them. And it's just insane. I mean, the fact is that the show itself was created for Black and Hispanic children who, quote-unquote, had no reading material in the home. That's what, that was the, in the words of the people who created it. And, you know, first of all, that's number one, that's soft bigotry of low expectations material, right? I mean, the idea that Black and Hispanic kids are too stupid to understand current television, so we have to create shows specifically for them with your taxpayer dollar. That's number one. Number two, the values that are promulgated on Sesame Street are kind of the next logical step in the leftist self-esteem movement of child rearing, right? In the 1960s, there's this Benjamin Spock idea that we were going to raise all kids based on the self-esteem notion. The most crucial things for a child is to feel unearned self-esteem, so we're going to push that. Well, the left embraced that wholeheartedly because they feel that nobody should really have to earn anything, so children should not have to earn self-esteem. Sesame Street pushed that notion to the next level. They said not only should you have self-esteem if you've never accomplished anything, you should have self-esteem for your culture, even if your culture has never accomplished anything. So we'll set this place in like a dirty, you know, on a dirty street where you have a friend who literally lives in a garbage can, and you should feel kind of proud and happy about this, right? I mean, it's far removed from the gentrified surroundings of previous children's television. And that liberalism obviously extends a lot deeper than that and in more obvious ways. I mean, there was, you know, a couple of years ago, there was the whole Fox News incident where Sesame Street started making fun of Fox News, which is obviously take off on Fox News. Right?
Sure.
And they've, after 9/11, Sesame Street decided it was a good time to run a series about peaceful conflict resolution, as though, you know, five-year-old kids who are watching Sesame Street were going to get up out of their chairs, run outside, find the local Muslim kid and beat him up. The website for Sesame Street has pushed gender-neutral language. It says that you ought to examine your own behavior for racial bias so that you can, you know, do good work in your anti-bias work with your children. It's all the liberal trope, and you know that's what it's really all about. The fact is that Sesame Street is not unique in this way. I mean, it really comes to its apex in Barney with regard to the self-esteem stuff. I mean, in Barney's horrible song, "Everybody Is Special," right? You know this one? Oh, you are special, special. Yeah. Everyone is special. Everyone in his or her own way, right? Down to alternative gender pronouns. I mean, it truly is incredible.
Right. Well, you know, when I was a kid back in the 60s, and I was born in 63, so I got in on Sesame Street at the very beginning, and back then they were quick to point out differences between people and things. You know, they had that little square chart they'd put up and they'd sing, "One of these things is not like the other. One of these things just doesn't belong." And of course, as we know now on Sesame Street, everybody belongs.
Yep, that's right. Everybody does belong. And regardless of culture, and I think that's really where the distinction is. Look, everybody does belong with regard to race, but I think that a fundamental distinction between liberal and conservative is the idea that not all cultures are equal, according to conservatives, and according to liberals, all cultures basically are equal.
I noticed in your book you said that the show Bewitched was full of double entendres. I have to be honest, I watched the show as a kid, and I didn't pick up on any of them, and I haven't revisited the show since. What did I miss?
Well, you know, I would have to rewatch the show to give you specific lines, but I remember watching while I was writing the book, and I was kind of surprised at how many double entendres were in Bewitched. It was shocking because when I first watched it as a kid, I also didn't get it. It went right over my head, right? But you know, whatever sexual material there was Uncle Arthur is a lot of double entendres.
Well, you know, one of the things that liberals like to make fun of is that conservative middle-class America didn't get the fact that Uncle Arthur, a.k.a. Paul Lynn, was gay. And to be honest
right.
with you, that never occurred to me back then.
Yeah. Well, you know, it doesn't occur to you. Look, he's the father in Bye Bye Birdie also. I mean, and Paul Lynn was, you know, a very openly gay guy, I think unless you were looking for it specifically, it's a little bit, you know, harder to find.
Well, let me throw some shows out at you from that time period, and you can tell me exactly what some of the liberal hidden messages were. I mean, shows like The Munsters, any liberal messaging there?
Well, actually, The Munsters was it started off as a cartoon that was drawn by Leonard Stern, I believe, and the message with Munsters was it was kind of reverse normal, right? I mean, it was actually supposed to be a little bit of a racial thing that, you know, they live in your neighborhood and yeah, they're different from you and they might be a little kooky, but they're still cool. There's no real reason that you should be freaked out by the Munsters.
And of course, the Addams Family was just a ripoff of the Munsters. What about shows like the Beverly Hillbillies? That whole little rural trio. Well, it wasn't really a rural trio. We had Green Acres, the Beverly Hillbillies, and Petticoat Junction, all put out by the same people. What types of messaging were they trying to get across with that little series of rural sitcom hits?
You know, I think that messaging actually tended toward the conservative because it was directly geared at rural audiences. The idea was that rural people, yeah, they may be a little bit hicky. You know, they're kind of hicks from the sticks, but by the same token, when it comes right down to it, they're the ones who are outsmarting all the big city folks all the time. So I think that by the way, the death of those shows is really the birth of hardcore liberalism on television because CBS dumped all those shows at the same time in the early 70s and put on instead Mary Tyler Moore, MASH, and All in the Family, which brings us to the era of modern television. And that was done for a very specific purpose that I think we may have already talked about. It was done because CBS wanted to attract the 18 to 49 crowd in the mistaken belief that those groups of people were better consumers than people who were 15 above. The people who were rural didn't really matter.
Were they dropped because of low ratings, or did the network just
decide? They had incredibly high ratings, actually. They were dropped because in the early 70s, there were only three major networks, right? There was ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And ABC was kind of relevant. ABC was getting its butt kicked by CBS. CBS was winning with Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, and Petticoat Junction. And so what ABC decided to do is they suddenly had to make the pitch to advertisers that while they were getting less viewers, those were the right viewers, right? And so what they said is our viewers, who happen to be young and urban and liberal, those ones are more valuable than other viewers. Well, the advertising agency executives, who tended to be by and large young, urban, and liberal, decided, okay, well, you know, if that's the case, then let's just put all of our money into young, urban, liberal programming. CBS, trying to head that off and also being headed up by a bunch of liberals itself, started buying into that demographic argument and dumped all of those shows in favor of the more harshly and, you know, stridently liberal shows like MASH and All in the Family.
So basically the Nielsen ratings is not what drives television today. It's not the final decider in what stays on the air and what gets kicked off.
No, I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, some shows get, you know, stay on the air simply because the executives like the show. You know, Hill Street Blues is a good example of that. Hill Street Blues, the first season, absolutely died. As a series, Hill Street, I think there were 83 shows in prime time that year. Hill Street came in, I think, 82nd. But they retained it because Grant Tinker was fond of the show. He helped produce it. And so he kept it. It's not just a strict ratings calculus that goes into this stuff. And by the way, you can have low ratings as long as it's the right people. So, for example, you know, last year, The Good Wife outrated Glee by a pretty sizable distance. The Good Wife, you know, got less than half the ad dollars that Glee did. Glee was getting 47 ad dollars per 1,000 viewers, and The Good Wife was getting less than half of that. And the reason for that is because Glee's viewers were supposedly, you know, they were younger, so the idea was that they were supposedly a better target for advertisers. There's only one problem with that, which is that it makes no sense. The people who actually have disposable income in this country are older, and this is an aging country with significant baby boomer population. So it's really a con job that's been put over on the advertising industry by the TV industry, and it helps keep TV liberal.
Well, as a former marketing person, I can tell you there's something to be said for segmenting an audience. For example, MTV had a very low viewership, but it was almost 100% teenage kids, and it was actually more cost-effective for people who sold, you know, Clearasil and Oxy pimple medication to advertise on MTV than to try to hit the big audiences, the broad audiences that ABC, NBC, and CBS were hitting. So there's something to be said for segmenting your audience, but to believe that a bunch of kids who are getting allowance, you know, have better or more disposable income than a bunch of retired people who are trying to figure out a way to spend their life savings, I don't know, it just doesn't make much sense.
You're exactly right. I mean, you know, niche audiences and narrow casting works for very audience-specific products. I mean, if you want to advertise the Weed Whacker, it's not worth advertising, you know, I'm a Good Wife for the Weed Whacker. You want to go to the Home and Garden channel, right? I mean, that's the place where your consumers are. But for the vast majority of products that are directed at the bulk of the American public, why would you possibly target young people over old people? It doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it really doesn't. And speaking of targeting, this doesn't involve you, Ben, but if any of the people who sell the ED medications are listening, I'm really sick of you guys advertising on conservative radio. Apparently, that is an older male audience because it's one ED commercial after another on the Patriot Network and some of the others. But moving on, where do you see things right now? How would you define television in its current state relative to the very liberal time period with Archie Bunker and MASH and a lot of the Mary Tyler Moore and Murphy Brown and all that stuff?
You know, it's less liberal than it was. It's less overtly liberal than it was. You still have a lot of liberalism on TV, but it's a little bit less strident. They hide the message a little bit better. The American public has also responded to the liberalism of TV by moving into, you know, areas of TV that they wouldn't have cared about before. The History Channel actually has a significant viewership, so does Discovery. But reality TV has filled in a huge gap for a lot of Americans because they're sick of the liberalism of scripted. At the same time, the Internet is starting to encroach on television's monopoly, and that is really, you know, making a huge impact in terms of the industry. I think it's making it possible for other people, conservatives, to get active, and I think it's important that we do.
You know, we got our butts kicked, we being conservatives, back in 2008, especially when it came to social media. Now, I know there are a lot of college kids who really get the ins and outs of Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, but I honestly think if we really tried hard, there's a resource that conservatives could tap into, and that's retired senior citizens. These people are becoming more computer literate every day, and frankly, they don't have to leave their computers to attend class or study for exams. So what do you think? I mean, can conservatives get it before 2012?
I think, in order for conservatives to really get it before 2012, they're going to have to get over their moral aversion to social media. I think that there's almost, for religious people, there's a tendency to stick our head in the sand and say, well, Facebook is bad because it allows people to hit on each other, and Twitter's bad because there's a lot of people on there cursing. So let's just boycott the medium. And I think that right-wing tendency to boycott the medium is such a mistake. Beyond which, I think that we don't understand, as conservatives, we tend to target individuals rather than institutions. The left isn't quite so stupid. They tend to target institutions rather than individuals because that's what they really care about. The problem is that institutions can target millions of people simultaneously. Well, if you're approaching millions of individuals, it's going to take a lot more time and effort. So it's about time the conservatives started getting active with regard to both social media and television and started trying to take back institutions of American culture rather than sitting aside and criticizing them.
Okay, so you're a conservative, you're sitting at home, you've never been on Twitter, you don't Facebook friend anybody, and you don't have the slightest idea how to put up a YouTube video. Where do you start? How do you get going?
Well, I mean, I think first thing first, you might as well, get a connection to the internet and check them out. But in terms of helping out with the entertainment project, I think that the first place you can go if your internet, if you do have an internet connection, is declarationentertainment.com. Declaration Entertainment is it's becoming a 501c3 group specifically dedicated to creating conservative entertainment, or rather, good entertainment that happens to be conservative. And I think that that's massively important. I think that, we need your money, we need your ideas, we need your advice, and we need your talent. So, email me through there, get involved, you can get a free copy of Primetime Propaganda at declarationentertainment.com if you subscribe. And I think it's important that we really start to get a little bit more active than we've been. When I say a little, I mean a lot.
Well, I think it's because a lot of people, as you said, tend to view the social networking mediums as a way for frustrated spouses to hook up with, someone on the internet. A lot of people think of Facebook, I won't get on Facebook. I hear too many stories of, people get on Facebook and the next thing they know they're meeting up with an old high school boyfriend or girlfriend, and the next thing their marriage is in shambles. And, there's so many things out there. It's almost reminiscent, Ben, of the early days of the internet when people really attacked the medium. And if a child predator lured a kid into, his house using the internet was bad, not the child predator. If a child predator, would stake out a playground at a school or a city park, nobody said the city park or the school was bad. In that case, the blame was put squarely where it belonged, and that was with the child predator. So I think among conservatives, there's still a little bit of that out there, that the internet is a bad place, it's a dangerous place. They're probably looking at what happened to Anthony Weiner and saying, hey, you see, this is what goes on in those social networking sites.
Look, just like anything else, I think everything is a tool, and we need to recognize that tools can be used for good or they can be used for bad. And if we instead just try and delegitimize the tool, if that's what we're really interested in doing, then take your computer, throw it out, take your car, throw it out, and go back to the horse and buggy. But guess what? There were still bad people using the horse and buggy for bad things. So it's important not to attack the medium, attack the message, and attack it from the inside by taking it over.
I remember in the last election, the Obama team released something like 2,000 videos on YouTube. And I think John McCain, probably somewhere under 400. I think that if we're going to match that type of firepower, we're going to need citizen journalists. We're going to need citizen filmmakers. We're going to need people who are willing to blog, people who are willing to vlog, people who are willing to do a podcast, people who are willing to put out a newsletter. I think for a lot of people, they kind of have this I don't know, this idea in their head that from a technical standpoint, it's just going to be too much for them. Can you give any advice whatsoever to people who want to get involved, in addition to the site you've given us, as far as different ways they can get involved?
Well, I mean, look, if you really want to get involved, email me. I'll task you. I'll tell you how to go out there and get a story. It's not that difficult. I mean, make sure that you bring your tape recorder. Make sure that you've checked out your local law so that you're not violating the law. And just ensure that, you know, go after people who ought to be targeted and make sure that they speak the truth to you. It's not that difficult. Most of them are willing to do it. So I think that it's vastly important that citizens do get involved, and I think that it requires them to, you know, get educated, first of all. Learn how to be a good journalist. Learn how to be a good artist. Don't just grab a camera and think you can make a movie. You can't. You need to train yourself. You need to. You really need to learn the ropes. It's not something that you can do, you know, just as a lark. It's a major undertaking. And if you're going to do it badly, don't bother doing it at all.
So, well, I wish I'd have heard you say that before I started trying, because I bought a green screen and I've been messing around with it. We'll see if any of these things turn out.
You know, if you want some advice on that, I work with the people who make Bill Whittle's firewall. We can help you with that.
Okay, fantastic. We'll all be sending you our emails. Now, I want to focus on you just a little bit, not the book. I was doing a little research on you on the internet, and I saw a picture of you looking like you might have been 10 years old, addressing what seemed to be a large political audience. How long have you been involved in speaking to public groups?
I've been doing this stuff since I was 17. It's been 10 years. I got my syndicated column when I was 17. My first book was published when I was, I think, 20. I've been a public conservative for a very, very long time, which is why it makes it so astonishing that nobody figured that out when I came in to do the interviews.
Well, you had the Harvard hat on.
Well, you know, that's really all that matters. I had the Harvard hat on, and my last name is Shapiro. That does it.
So they thought, well, there's no way this kid's conservative. No, I was reading your background. It's very impressive. You began UCLA at age 16, graduated, was it summa cum laude? And then Harvard Law School, you were out by, what, 23? And you had graduated cum laude there. So impressive academic record. In fact, as I reviewed it, I was thinking, and it was actually struck by the similarities with my own background. I, too, was a teenager when I entered college, but I was 18. And frankly, I refused to declare a major until my parents threatened to cut off funding. But a lot of similarities there between the two of us. You're not laughing. That was supposed to be funny.
I am. It's just it's a soft laugh.
Okay. Yeah. Inside where it counts, you're laughing with me. But it's an impressive background. So I guess what I want to know, Ben, is what does the future hold for a really bright guy like you who's been a conservative all along? It's fantastic that you're writing books and you're appearing on television. I believe you have your own radio show. But I'm looking at you and I'm thinking this might be America's future. Any plans to run for public office in the future?
You know, down the line, I would be interested in running for public office. I obviously would have to do it probably someplace outside California, just because California is such a liberal state. But I would love to, I'd love to serve the community. But before I do that, there's a lot I'd like to do in terms of the cultural debate, continuing to shape it, making some movies, making some TV, changing the cultural landscape a little bit more than it's already been changed. Because unless we fight them on a cultural level, we're just not going to win.
You know, that's one of the things I read in the book, and I have to admit I disagreed with you a little bit, because you were saying rather than boycott them, join in the fight, you know, contribute to what's out there, you know, put out your own media. Conservatives, as you pointed out, are older. There's more disposable income, and that should make us more valuable to advertising and to advertisers and therefore to the networks. Conservative consumers, if they wanted to, could flex a considerable amount of purchasing muscle. Why don't we do that, and why don't you think that's a good idea?
I think that boycotting just doesn't work as a general matter, because most consumers are not willing to boycott all of television. I mean, it really is that easy, and so much of TV is liberal that in order for us to be really effective, we'd have to just stop watching TV, and we're not going to do that, because when we watch TV, we're not interested in the politics. We just want to be entertained. So that's why I think it is vitally important that we create our own entertainment, because it's not enough to tell advertisers not to advertise in certain places. They have eyeballs. We need to create places that have even more eyeballs that advertisers can shift their money from one place to another. They're not going to take their money out of the market, and I wouldn't want them to for economic reasons. What I'd prefer that they do is shift their money from places that, you know, are promoting values which I disagree to promoting to you know programs that promote values of the show. I agree.
Well, you said you want to get involved in putting television out there. Are you just talking news-related stuff, or are you considering maybe putting out entertainment?
Yeah, I'm talking sitcoms. I'm talking dramas. I'm talking reality TV. We need to get involved at all levels, and that means raising a fair bit of money. And look, I have a buddy right now who's down on the border making a movie called The Arroyo, which is a which is basically a cross between No Country for Old Men and High Noon, and it's a and it's an anti-illegal immigration flick, right? I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we ought to be doing. We can't just do it on a political level, because the fact is that there are only so many of us who want to watch Fox News at a given time. A lot of us would rather, you know, flip on a good movie.
Have you thought about going back and remaking some of the classic sitcoms and do it with conservative messaging, you know, tucked within?
You know, it would be fun to be. Look, everything in Hollywood is old. There's no such thing as a really new idea, except for maybe Christopher Nolan's Inception. Everything is based on something else old. That's why, you know, when I say that the movie is a cross between No Country for Old Men and High Noon, that's actually how you pitch things in Hollywood. It's a cross between X and Y, right? So that's exactly how you would do it. You'd go back to a successful sitcom like Cosby Show, and you'd basically remake it. Or you'd go back to a successful sitcom like All in the Family, except you'd make Archie, you know, a kind of annoying liberal, and you'd make his son a righteous conservative. I mean, you always want to base it on something successful. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
You know, that's not a bad idea. You could have this sort of long-haired old man, and he's constantly smoking pot, and the son-in-law's getting on to him, and, you know, I don't know what you'd call a show like that, but it's not a bad idea. I tell you what, I'm going to start working on it, and I'll submit show ideas to you via email, Ben.
Sounds good.
Hey, before we have to end the show, tell the listeners how they can get a hold of a copy of your book.
You can go to Amazon.com. You can buy it there. If you want a free copy of the book, you can subscribe to DeclarationEntertainment.com, become a member, and I'll send you a free signed copy of the book. And you can also go to my website, and you can purchase it through there as well, BenjaminShapiro.com.
Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to slap all those links up on our website so people can just come to TeaPartyPowerHour.com, and we will have all of those links put up, and you can pick the link that you most want to click on and buy an autographed copy or a regular copy or whatever you want to do. Well, I got to tell you, Ben, I think the timing on this book was really good. Hopefully sales have been good for you. And I'm also hoping that you're getting some interviews on places in addition to Fox News. Are you able to get on CNN and MSNBC and some of those places?
I just did the speech that I just did at Heritage Foundation is going to be broadcast on C-SPAN on the 24th. I was on MSNBC and had a nice, interesting back and forth with Martin Bashir, which I posted at my website, and you can find it on YouTube as well. I did appear on CNN. I've appeared on, you know, and then obviously on a lot of the conservative, you know, a lot of the conservative websites and radio and television. And you know, a lot of the mainstream press has gotten a hold of it. The LA Times did a piece on it. I did an interview with their liberal columnist. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution is going to be doing a piece on it over the weekend. The foreign press had a field day with it. I mean, I just did an interview with the UK Daily Mail. They've already done a feature piece in the UK Telegraph, and that one went, you know, viral all over the world. That's where the left came from when they started attacking me on Sesame Street. That was the point of the first article was an attempt to kind of paint me as a Jerry Falwell Teletubbies guy, which I'm not. So it has gotten very, very wide play from both right and the left, and left is finding it very difficult to deal with.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but did not people who've worked on Sesame Street admit some of that bias, or am I thinking of another show?
No, they absolutely did. I mean, I interviewed Mike Dan, who is the vice president of Children's Television Workshop at the Inception. And he said the show was designed for black and Hispanic kids, not for white or upper or middle class people. It was designed for poor black and Hispanic kids because, in his words, that there was, quote unquote, no reading material in the black household. I mean, this is soft bigotry of low expectations material if I've ever heard it.
One of the things as a kid growing up in the rural South that I couldn't get past was just the accents. You know, I mean, I'm sure you're picking up on the slight Texas accent with me, but if you're in Texas and you're listening to Sesame Street at age 7, you're asking your mom, why do these people sound this way? I still remember the kid, the little girl who was going to the store for a loaf of bread, a potato and milk, and a stick of butter. And, you know, as a Texan, I'm wondering, who talks that way? So it was kind of confusing. I don't think they meant it for little rural southern kids either. But my question, what I was leading to with this is, if the people involved with Sesame Street are willing to admit that it had a liberal bias, how can the media be upset with you for repeating what they've said and for simply using people who worked on the show to confirm it? I mean, what possible argument do they have when the people who worked on the show admit it?
They don't really have an argument. I mean, it's mostly just an attempt to slander me, right? I mean, they ignore the fact that I have people on tape admitting this stuff, and instead they just try and turn it into, oh, he wants to kill Elmo and Big Bird. I mean, I actually got some flack for that. Yeah, I said that on Sean Hannity's program. I mean, I said that the left is making it out like I want to take Elmo and Big Bird out back and cap them, right? And the left went nuts. Oh, my God, he's using violent rhetoric. It's like the kind of rhetoric that led to Gabby Giffords. And I responded in print to that, and it was like, you know, do they recognize that Elmo and Big Bird are not, in fact, real people?
I don't think they do.
That they're puppets and therefore, by nature, immortal.
Right. Now, I will say this. You talked about a lot of the liberal messaging being subtle. I've always been a little suspicious about the relationship between Ernie and Bert. I mean, I'm sorry.
You're not the only one. There are a lot of people who say that. The roommates in New York, my guess is, I don't think that it was meant to be a gay thing. I think it was meant to be I'm pretty sure it was meant to be an Oscar and, it was meant to be an odd couple thing, right? It was supposed to be the slobby roommate who's Bert and the, or Ernie, and the, I can never remember which one's Bert and which one's Ernie.
Ernie was the one who laughed like this.
Right, exactly. Okay, appreciate it.
No problem at all.
Well, the short, fat one, who's Ernie, is constantly messy and kind of screwing things up. And then there's the uptight one, who's like the Jack Lemmon character.
Gotcha. Okay, now I get it. I just thought that it seemed like Bert was kind of always walking in on Ernie when he was taking a bath, and I don't know. Maybe I'm just reading. Maybe I'm reading way too much into.
You know, I'm not going to go there. If the puppets are gay, then at a certain point, maybe we'll find out that they did this revisionist history where Bert and Ernie were gay. But I think that it's a tough case to make, at least from the beginning.
Well, J.K. Rowling came out after the fact and said that Dumbledore was gay. So
I guess that was what a load of crap that was. Like, well, that was very gutsy of you. You know, if you'd written that in the first book, then you would have killed your sales by half, but you wait until after you finish the book, and then you turn Dumbledore gay. Well done.
Absolutely. I think that was, when I heard that, I just thought, there is nothing about that character that is gay. That's just her playing to a liberal audience. Absolutely hilarious that she would even attempt to do that. But, it's like, I think I'm having an experience now, and again, I'm not finished with the book, but I'm having an experience now that when I'm watching television, I sort of have the blinders off, and to a certain extent, it's not as enjoyable as it was because I'm looking for these hidden liberal messages, some of which are not so subtle and some actually are. But you mentioned you were a big fan of Law and Order, correct?
I was when I was in law school, and it's gotten progressively worse. I mean, right now it's so blatant. I mean, I watched an episode of Law and Order about a night ago, I can't remember which one. They have so many series. It was the one with Vincent D'Onofrio, it was just the most egregious anti-corporate, oh, look, a white corporate corrupt guy who's doing something bad. There's a shock. whenever you see somebody – here, a hint to all of you who watch Law & Order. Whenever you meet a character who is an upper-class white male who works at a big corporation, eventually you will find that he killed somebody.
Well, one of the things they had on there, and I'm pretty sure it was Law & Order. I don't watch a lot of television. I am one of those people who watches mostly Fox News. And one of the shows involved some guy who was setting up a ring of men who like to abuse little boys, And the guy who was behind it was giving this speech about, well, you know, only a few decades ago, homosexuals were treated this way. And eventually you're going to see that a sexual relationship between a child and an adult is a perfectly natural thing. And even though everyone, all the characters on the set, of course, reacted negatively and thought this guy was sick, I'm wondering, was this an attempt to give that bizarre part of our society a voice? Was this an
Well, I mean, it's certainly shedding a spotlight on that part of the society. I mean, what's so funny is that, of course, there won't be anybody there who says, you know, he's kind of got a point, right? I mean, from the perspective of it's defining deviancy down, that's 100% correct. I mean, you know, it wasn't long ago that we were hearing that when you know, Jerry Studs was molesting, you know, older pages, that was okay. And, you know, now they're making the argument that if you're 16 or 17 and you're molested, that's not really molestation if it's consensual. I mean, lowering the age of consent is the next thing on the left's agenda. There's no question about that.
Well, I know that when Barney Frank was caught having the relationship with a 17-year-old prostitute, his defense was, hey, Massachusetts, legal age of consent is 16. Right now, Anthony Weiner's got to be wondering how in the hell Barney Frank stayed in Congress and he has to go.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was writing a column this week that started off, you know, and Anthony Weiner at this point must really wish that he were black or gay, because if he were, he'd still be in Congress.
That's a good point. I mean, especially the gay part, because we saw it happen with Barney Frank. Frank.
If you look at his latest photos, you know, there is something to wonder about. The guy is cross-dressing, right?
I haven't seen the latest photos.
Oh, yeah, that's the latest. Go to the front page of the National Enquirer.
Okay, when you say he's cross-dressing, Frank or Weiner?
Oh, no, Weiner.
Oh, wow. My goodness. This man is very...
You're missing out.
I am missing out. You know, I don't really understand why... Oh, never mind. Here's a guy who's got it all. He's got a beautiful wife. Kids, he's, you know, got a powerful position. What the hell was he thinking, man, showing his face on Twitter, sending out pictures? I mean, you know, I haven't seen something this stupid since Jimmy Swaggart was, you know, trolling the bad neighborhoods for skanks. I mean, I just don't get it.
He's a genius. I mean, go to National Enquirer right now and you can see him wearing hot pants and a bra. I am totally serious.
God, who's he think he is, Marv Albert? All right, I'll leave that alone. Well, listen, Ben, you've been very kind to share a lot of your time here with us today. I wish you the best success with this book, and want to point out to the listeners, he's written a lot of other books too, so we'll try to put those links up as well. And we're gonna keep an eye on you, Ben, because no pressure here, but we expect great things in the future as well.
I appreciate it. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Ben. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.